To the primary last night and to Trump's pretty much trouncing of Nikki Haley.
We saw it coming, and it still felt awful here in New Hampshire. The various tactics to slow it down didn't work. But maybe the lesson that I think we can take from New Hampshire is we're still seeing a lot of media speak of Nikki Haley. Can she go on? New York Times says this raises questions. The questions have long been settled. Trump is the nominee. Fascism is on the ballot. And I think that was clear in New Hampshire. I think it's also worth noticing that here in New Hampshire, when you talk to folks, yeah, there was opposition to Haley, or I'm sorry, opposition to Trump. But no one is saying they won't vote for Trump if he's the nominee. This was not strong support for Haley. Let's move on. I don't even want to talk about South Carolina. I don't want to talk about Nevada. I want to talk about how we look at this thing that is threatening us nationally.
Jeff, you tweeted that New Hampshire is not a, quote, moderate state, that there is no damn moderate state anymore. Could you explain?
Yeah, I think the confusion that a lot of people had is that in really reductive terms, New Hampshire leans libertarian. It's form of conservatism, a right wing reactionary politics is libertarian. I mean, we have a not insignificant secessionist movement in our state legislature called the Free State Movement, which actually began here at Dartmouth College. Whereas Iowa, the form of reactionary politics was evangelical. And I think a lot of the political press is stuck in an old paradigm of social conservatives or business conservatives. Those things have merged. You see it clearly in some of the plans that are now being formulated for a second Trump term. They're not going to be caught, you know, surprised when he comes back to office. So, for instance, the Right Wing Heritage Foundation, working with 74 other major groups, both evangelical and libertarian leaning, have come up with something called Project 2025. It begins with evangelical values, putting the family first, saving the children. And it goes on to saying, let's realign the goals of America with management. This coming, by the way, from the Republicans, which is fooling people, some people, into thinking it's a workers' party. It's an openly pro-big business and pro-so-called family values, which, of course, are being expressed now as hate values.
Play a clip of Jamie Dimon last week at the World Economic Forum. The J.P. Morgan CEO talked about how Trump has been right on many issues. This is Dimon on CNBC.
I don't think they're voting for Trump because of his family values. Now, if you look, just take a step back, be honest. He was kind of right about NATO, kind of right about immigration. Mm-hmm. He grew the economy quite well.
China virus.
Tax reform worked.
Can you respond, Jeff Charlotte? It's not only Jamie Dimon, that consensus at Davos, that Trump's going to win.
Yeah, I'm so glad you played that clip. I think that was really important because we see if we look back at the history of how fascist movements grow, and I want to emphasize it's a fascist movement, it's not yet a fascist government. There is a chance to stop it, but we see a period of adaptation. And that was what you saw at Davos, those folks playing the odds and saying, could I get together? Could I work in a coalition with people? I mean, he's no leftist, he's no liberal, but could I work in a coalition with people to stop this fascism? Or could I find a way to prosper in it? And the vote at Davos was prosper within fascism. So when we look at the coalitions that we need to build to stop it, we're going to have to think other places. Not that anyone thought that Davos was a place to start building coalitions, but it does need to be broad.
I wanted to go to Donald Trump addressing the Republican Jewish Coalition annual leadership summit in October. And this goes to the number one issue in New Hampshire, which was immigration.
They want to destroy our country. They want to destroy our country. Under Biden, we have not one but two immigration disasters. We have one on the border, and we have one in the Biden State Department, which is admitting colossal amounts of jihadists into our communities and campuses and our refugee programs. That's why you see all of these big demonstrations in New York, in Chicago. Nobody can believe what's taking place. They're letting them in. at levels that nobody's ever seen before. We cannot allow that to happen. And we don't want to be like Europe with jihads on every corner. That's what happens. I mean, we're going to be like Europe. You take a look at London, you take a look at Paris, you take a look at what's going on over there. We want to be the United States of America, and we want to make our country great again. Right now, we don't have a great country. We have a laughing stock. As president, I will end once and for all the mass importation of anti-Semitism into the United States. And just as I did before, we will keep radical Islamic terrorists the hell out of our country. We're going to keep them out of our country. We were keeping them out. We were keeping them out.
Jeff Charlotte, if you could respond to those comments of Donald Trump, especially given the fact that New Hampshire is probably one of the states perhaps least affected by immigration in the United States, given its distance from the southwest border.
Yeah. At first, I sort of want to say Trump says he's going to end the mass importation of anti-Semitism in the United States, which doesn't happen. He alone is responsible for a lot of made in America anti-Semitism. It's one of his products. But the question of immigration, I think of a voter in, I think it was Bedford, New Hampshire, who's a very wealthy community, described her way herself as on the way to play pickleball. She stopped to vote for Trump. Her issues were, we've got to get the immigrants out. She didn't say undocumented people. She didn't say illegal immigrants. She said, we've got to get all the immigrants out so the economy can grow. And once again, you see there this kind of the old political press of sort of breaking down on issues. Do you care about social issues? Do you care about immigration? Do you care about economics? In Trumpism, all these things merge. And you heard that, too, in that response where he's invoking this a fear word of jihad. The way Trumpism works is it adds enemies. It moves on. 5 years ago, Trumpism wasn't particularly talking about trans rights. New Hampshire is now a frontline state in the struggle for trans freedom, as our legislature takes up the kind of laws you're seeing also in places like Utah. But what it does, what Trumpism is doing in each one of these speeches, and why we have to keep paying attention, and I know the temptation is strong to say, look, we know what he is, we know all this. We need to see how the movement's growing, how the movement's mutating, how it's taking the original fear of Islam that it began with and adding more and more fears and then combining them so that they're indistinguishable in the mind of the Trump voter.
So what is the way forward for those who are opposed to this growing fascism, especially given the fact that so many young people in the United States who played such a key role in the last election are being increasingly turned off by the war policies of the Biden administration?
Yeah, and that young people are don't want to vote for Biden. I'm here at Dartmouth College. If I encountered any students who wrote in Biden, they didn't tell me about it. They either voted for, as they told me, that guy from Minnesota, Dean Phillips, so that they could not vote for Biden, or they voted for Haley as what they thought of as a tactical vote against Trump. That's significant. Also significant, I think we really need to contend with this, is if you look at the Republican primary voters who voted for Trump, his strongest contingent was in the youth. And I think for a long time in American politics, it's as much of a truism, and I'll say it's as much of a truism on the left as so much of the kind of old maxims of political journalism that aren't working, is that the young will save us, that the youth will save us. We look at Trump growing his support in the 18 to 29 sector. We look at Trump growing his support, paradoxically, amongst those former 20 Biden voters most critical of what Biden is doing in Gaza. Okay, so what's their solution? A significant number of them have been conned into the idea that Trump is an anti-war candidate, the guy who is, you hear this rhetoric as well, Trump never stopped any wars. Trump is able to play both sides. He says, I'm going to raise Gaza. And at the same time, he's able, in an age of diminishing media, and you started the show with the Baltimore Sun going down, and Gene Guerrero at LA Times, who I should note, what is the preeminent expert on Stephen Miller, and the LA Times lets her go. So there's less and less information for young voters, and they're going to be more vulnerable to what the con Trump is trying to give them. So how do we do it? I don't have a, I'm not a, a political strategist, but I do think it's popular front time. It's broad coalition time. And I don't know how we build a left liberal alliance to stop Trump. I'm not going to tell anybody to vote for Biden, but I know we got to stop Trump.
I wanted to follow up, Jeff, on something you said before about the importation of anti-Semitism, and Trump is most responsible for that, you said. I mean, going back to University, for example, of Virginia, that march in Charlottesville, of those saying Jews will not replace us, Jews will not replace us, the white supremacists, from there to the insurrection. We're going to have a debate on Trump being taken off the ballot in various states. But on that issue of what, in fact, he represents, what the insurrection was about, what his role with the University of Virginia protests, what his comments on them.
Yeah, I think, right, in Charlottesville, where they chanted, Jews will not replace us. I think, you know, Trump has managed to do something new in the anti-Semitism field, which is quite, it's quite an accomplishment when you think about it. He has this age-old hatred, and he's managed to innovate, which is to say that he's created a kind of anti-Semitism. And you saw it, for instance, in the speech he gave after his first indictment, where he leads off by saying, what's Jack Smith's real name? But the real tell was the line, we're going to drive out the globalists, chase out the communists. These terms, which are heard as synonyms for Jews in an abstract sense, those he's quoting there two different gospels from the New Testament, drive out and chase out, just to make sure no one missed it. But then tweaking it a little bit and making anti-Semitism such that the explicit anti-Semites, and they're out there. I think of folks like Charlie Kirk, I believe it is, at Turning Point USA, who are starting to question the what they used to call the Judeo part of Judeo-Christian values. Well, I mean, good. This is a kind of a narrow and bigoted idea of America, but they're saying, no, it's just Christian. So on the one hand, you've got the hardcore anti-Semites being pleased. On the other hand, you've got Trump playing to this idea of an international banker. Look at the people who he says are really behind Nikki Haley. It sounds like he's saying Rothschild. He is the one who's producing anti-Semitism, and at the same time, he's campaigning and just as he's conning some young people, conning some Jewish voters into thinking that he somehow is not introducing a new level of hate into the United States based on his promise to build on the genocide in Israel and make it even worse.
Jeff Charlotte, I want to thank you for being with us, journalist and author, professor of English and creative writing at Dartmouth College in Hanover, New Hampshire, where he's speaking to us from. He's author of the book The Undertow, Scenes from a Slow Civil War. Up next, should Donald Trump be barred from running for president for his role in the January 6th attack on the Capitol? Or is taking Trump off the ballot an anti-democratic measure that'll only energize his base? We'll host a debate. Stay with us. Song by the Four Tops. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Former President Trump's the clear front runner in the race for the Republican nomination, despite the fact he faces 91 criminal charges in various cases related to mishandling classified documents, arranging payoffs, seeking to overturn the 2020 presidential election. It's that last charge related to the January 6, 2021 attack on the Capitol that's the cause of most controversy. There are efforts nationwide to remove Trump from the 2024 presidential ballot based on the 14th Amendment, which says public officials who have, quote, engaged in insurrection, unquote, are disqualified from ever serving again. On February 8th, the Supreme Court will hear an appeal from Donald Trump after judges in Colorado ruled the former president is ineligible to appear on the Colorado primary ballot. The Secretary of State of Maine also barred Trump from the ballot, but a judge ruled he should stay on the ballot until the Supreme Court rules on the issue. Did Trump violate the Constitution? Should he be barred from running for president? Or is taking Trump off the ballot an anti-democratic measure that'll only energize his base? We're hosting a debate with two guests. In Washington, D.C., we're joined by Praveen Fernandez, the vice president at the Constitutional Accountability Center, which filed an amicus brief in the Colorado lawsuit enforcing Trump's constitutional disqualification. We're also joined by Samuel Moyne, a professor of law and history at Yale University. His recent piece for The New York Times is headlined, "The Supreme Court Should Overturn the Colorado Ruling Unanimously." Professor Moyne is joining us today from Toronto. Let's begin with Praveen Fernandez. Talk about why you back these efforts, state by state, from Colorado to Maine, to take Trump off the ballot.
We've always been committed to enforcing the text and history of the Constitution, and that includes the text and history of Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. Here, for our democracy, it could not be more important than to hold accountable Donald Trump for his actions around January 6th, 2021. And so this is important not only for holding Donald Trump accountable, but it's also important for giving meaning to a constitutional provision that was designed precisely for instances just like this.
And Samuel Moyne, you disagree. You've written in the New York Times that to bar Mr. Trump from the ballot now would be the wrong way to show him to the exits of the political system after all these years of strife. Why do you think that?
Donald Trump's clearly a menace, and getting rid of him is a huge priority, but everything depends on how it's done. And I really have two concerns. First, a legal one. The legal case isn't airtight under this provision of the Constitution. And the risk is that millions of Americans who back Trump and have looked past or forgiven what he did on January 6th will regard the Supreme Court's intervention as illicit, much the way we all think Bush v. Gore was a tragic mistake. And then there's strategy. I worry that getting rid of Trump this way could backfire. And in particular, it saves the Democrats from the obligation to make their case to the American people that they should win.
Praveen Fernandez, what about this issue of granting more power to the Supreme Court in terms of elections, and also the issue of how the Trump base might react to this removal of him from the ballot?
Well, I mean, I think we can have, a separate conversation about whether the Supreme Court as an institution, commands more power vis-a-vis the other branches. But there's no reason for particular modesty for the U.S. Supreme Court with respect to enforcing Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. So I think that there's no reason for the Supreme Court to run away from the text and history of this provision. And I guess I'm skeptical of this notion that somehow leaving it to the voters is a better strategy. I think the voters certainly spoke in 2020 and resoundingly chose President Biden. President Trump at that time challenged the results of those elections in more than 60 cases and lost. And despite realizing that he lost, sometimes at the hands of judges that he had appointed, and despite all of his closest advisors explaining that he had lost, Trump and a violent faction of his supporters tried to wrest power by force, thwarting the will of the electorate. So this notion that somehow leaving it to the voters will somehow get us out of this problem, I don't think is convincing to me.
I'm wondering if Professor Moyne can give us the history of the 14th Amendment, and particularly Section 3. Talk about the Civil War and the decisions made afterwards to keep Confederates from running for office.
It's a great amendment. If that's all there were in the Constitution, I'd be much more favorable to that document and to the Supreme Court interpreting it. And it was noble after the Civil War for the radical Republicans who had done so much to, you know, free the slaves through war to pass the 14th Amendment, which tried to impose democracy after the war on the South by keeping ex-Confederates, ex-insurrectionaries from running. And there's no doubt that that was the purpose of Section 3. There's a couple of problems, though. I admire Praveen, but there are just doubts about whether it's applicable now, whether it covers presidents who were allegedly insurrectionaries, whether Congress has to act first, and there are other objections too. But then there's a bigger issue, which is that Section 3 was passed after the Civil War, when the opposition, the insurrectionaries, had been beaten militarily. We're in a situation in which Donald Trump is enormously popular. You said, Amy, that he trounced his opposition last night, and Democrats have to meet that opposition. Now, Praveen's right that there's a risk of violence no matter what. But do we want to have another civil war standing on some interpretation from five judges of an old document? Or do we want the Democrats to offer a credible program for the future of America and then defend that come what may?
Praveen, what about that argument and also the viewpoint of some that this is an attempt to circumvent the democratic process and to use lawfare as a means of preventing a candidate from coming to office?
Well, I don't think that this requirement is any more anti-democratic than a number of other constitutional requirements for the presidency. So we've never left that just to the voters. The Constitution, as you know, sets an age requirement for the presidency. You have to be 35. It says you have to be naturally born, a natural born citizen. We have never said, well, this is an immensely popular 29-year-old, so we should leave it to the voters. Or the Constitution also provides that you can only serve two terms. So if there's an immensely popular president, we've never said, you know, we should leave this to the voters. This is a constitutional requirement, and the Constitution itself is a democratically enacted instrument. So it was not only democratically enacted, but it was adopted by the high thresholds that we have for constitutional provisions. It was passed by two-thirds majorities in the House and Senate. It was ratified by three-fourths of the states. And so we as a nation have agreed to be bound to these rules in the Constitution. And so I don't think this is any more anti-democratic than a number of other constitutional provisions about the requirements and qualifications for the presidency.
Praveen,
and I also
go ahead.
I'm so sorry. I would also say I don't think this is an either-or proposition. Where I agree with Professor Moyne is certainly there is a place for other candidates to make their case for a better and brighter vision for the nation and to win the public narrative strategy. And I don't see that as an either-or situation. I think that has to happen, but that shouldn't be a reason for us to run away from the text and history of this constitutional provision.
Wanted to also get your response to whether this applies to the president, and then also take that to should everyone convicted in 2021, and there are hundreds and hundreds of people who have been convicted for their role in the insurrection, should they never be allowed to serve public office?
So those are good questions. I'll take the first one first. The subject of our amicus brief at the Constitutional Accountability Center in the Colorado case was on the Section 3 of the 14th Amendment applying to the president as an officer and the presidency as an office. And we looked at the text and history of this amendment. We looked at the textual analysis, the enactment history, the documents, the debates around it. And then we also looked at the plan that the framers had for Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. And it just doesn't make any sense in terms of another interpretation of this provision, not applying it to the president and the presidency. The worries that we see that the framers of this provision had, that officers who had broken their oath to support the Constitution would then be able to serve office again and be a destabilizing element in our democracy. It makes no sense for the framers to have been worried about insurrectionist postmasters and low-level officials, but not concerned with the most powerful office in our land. So I would say, yes, it does apply to the president as an officer of the United States, and it does apply to the presidency as an office under the United States. I think your second question, sorry. Yeah, please go ahead.
Yeah, Praveen, I just wanted to ask you if even supposing that Trump was in violation of Section 3, wouldn't the proper remedy be to ask a federal district court to remove him from office if he's elected, not for a state official to remove him from the ballot?
Well, so that's also a great question. It's hard to see how that would be any more fair to voters after they have cast ballots for somebody who is constitutionally ineligible to serve. This robs them of the choice to have voted for somebody else in the primary stage. If this is somebody who is constitutionally ineligible to serve, it's hard to see how it would be more fair to allow the election to play out and then to take away their choice, as well as their option to have voted for somebody else, if this had been determined earlier. So I think all parties are benefited from a clear decision from the Supreme Court earlier rather than later. And if I could just backtrack to, I think it was Amy's question earlier about what this means for other individuals who participated in the insurrection. I would just say that there's a very narrow thing. This applies only to officers who took an oath and then violated it, so not
we're giving
just all the individuals.
Professor Moyne, the last word. You say that progressives should focus on making Biden a more appealing candidate than removing Trump from the ballot. Your final comments.
Amy, in 1937, Franklin Roosevelt said, if you keep talking about saving democracy, but you mean going back to the way it was, we don't follow you. And these legalistic strategies, what Juan called lawfare, all the way back into the Trump presidency, have really been ways of trying to put things back the way they were, rather than recognizing that a lot of American people are willing to bracket Trump's evil and vote for him anyway, because the Democrats are not appealing. And that's the challenge I think we all need to face, rather than side with centrist Democrats and never Trump Republicans who just want to get rid of Trump as if nothing happened.
We want to thank you both for being with us. Samuel Moyne, professor of law and history at Yale University. We'll link to your New York Times op-ed, the Supreme Court should overturn the Colorado ruling unanimously. And Praveen Fernandez, vice president of Constitutional Accountability Center, who filed an amicus brief in the Colorado lawsuit. That does it for our show. Happy birthday to Tarina Nodura. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Open Mic on CJSF 90.1 is where you can listen to fresh new releases from any genre, any day of the week. Visit cjsf.ca for the latest open mic schedule.
Radio Rewind. Now we wait it. Radio Rewind. Now we wait it. Radio Rewind. Radio Rewind. The following content has previously aired on CJSF. But don't worry, we'll be back next week with fresh content. CJSF 90.1 FM. Diverse. Independent. Yours.